Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Welcome to Coffee House Shops, The Spectator's daily politics podcast, live from the Conservative Party conference in Manchester. I'm Fraser Nelson. I'm joined by James Forsyth, Katie Bowles, Charles Grant, and David Gough, and about 200 of observers of the political scene here in the room with us today. Now, this is quite a big day. Not only is it the busiest day of the Tory Party conference, but it is the day that Boris Johnson is going to spend in his hotel room, a few floors up from here, calling various EU leaders trying to sell this deal which he is putting. This is, we did a cover in the magazine a few weeks ago showing a throw of the dice. I'm not quite sure if it's too bold to say this is his last throw of the dice, but it feels like it. So James, what do we know of the contours of a deal? I mean, we know that Boris has given the details of the deal to the EU because they always leak it to Brussels, so to Dublin. Dublin always leak it to RTE, and RTE always trashes it as being insignificant. So we've had that little ritual played out. So RTE has announced the arrival, unwittingly, of the latest proposals. What do they look like?
So the government are saying that what was briefed out last night is not what the proposal is. But what was said last night was that there would be border checkpoints about 5-10 miles away from the border, essentially just pulling the border a little bit back from the border. But I mean, the most significant thing that Boris Johnson said in his Today programme interview this morning was when he said, "You're going to have to be checks on the island of Ireland," under his scheme, under his plan. When you take against that, that for the EU and for Dublin, it is a red line, but there can't be checks on the island of Ireland. And they point out, not unreasonably, but Theresa May signed up to this position in the joint report. I really struggle to see how these talks are going to get anywhere. Indeed, I think there is a real question about whether the talks even actually take place. I mean, there is a very good chance that the proposals land, and it becomes quite clear that the two sides are so far apart that we don't even go into the European Council thinking there is going to be the prospect of some dramatic last-minute agreement. It's clearly all over before then. At the moment, I just think the fact that the EU know that if there isn't a deal, it's going to be an extension rather than no deal.
Do they know that?
I think they are understandably confident, given both the Benn Act and the Supreme Court verdict last week, that the UK government would not be able to do no deal on the 31st of October. And so I think for that reason, they won't be inclined to move, inclined to basically try and put a bow around Theresa May's deal and present it as something entirely different.
Okay. So, Katie, if that's the case, things go as the way Jane's outlined, Boris makes his best offer. He might even publish, who knows, his best offer in printed form in the way that Brussels has always asked for. And if it's clear that it's being immediately rejected, then what happens between now and, is it the 17th of October that the letter is supposed to be sent out? 19th, sorry.
Yeah, and I think at that point we start to head to this showdown, which I believe is probably what people see as the most likely scenario, if there is such a thing as a most likely scenario in British politics these days, which is a showdown ultimately between Boris Johnson and Parliament that probably ends up in the courts. So if Boris Johnson can't get a Brexit deal, or the Brexit deal he gets isn't something he thinks he can risk trying to put through Parliament without giving ammunition to Nigel Farage's Brexit party, he will say this is a small change, this is the withdrawal agreement dressed up, and this is a Brexit betrayal. So if all that looks too risky, I think you see Boris Johnson saying, well, I'm not going for this, but I'm also not going to seek an extension. I've said it's do or die. Number 10, he believed they have found a loophole around this Hillary Benn legislation that has passed. Now, that legislation, which David Gough helped to get through Parliament, basically tries... some claps there, so we have a mixed reaction. But yes, so that legislation, ultimately, the idea is it forces the Prime Minister to seek an Article 50 extension and to write a letter. Boris Johnson does not want to write a letter seeking an Article 50 extension because he thinks it would be politically damaging. You hear things of extension means extinction for the Tory party. How does he get around it? I think the fact that there are so many theories about how you might get around this shows you that there isn't really a clear plan. And I think that perhaps there is a clear plan in the mind of some of Boris Johnson's most senior aides. But I think even if they have a tactic, there is a general sense in Downing Street and government that it's not going to be a clear-cut issue. I don't think they're going to pull a rabbit out of the hat the day they're supposed to call the extension and see, actually, look, the bill that you passed has no meaning because we're doing this. And then everyone says, okay, got it, Boris. We're not going to force you to get this extension. It's not going to be a done deal. And I think there is an which means that they don't have to comply by this bill, is going to be contested, and we're going to be ending up back in the courts with another situation where we are having courts meeting politics and a Brexit showdown. And I think that the expectation, again, if we keep trying to think what might happen, is that the government could probably lose that. But I think really it's more about the narrative. Boris Johnson ultimately has to do everything possible to show that he is trying every lever, everything he has, to not seek an extension. I think that at this conference, we heard a few months ago that Dominic Cummings had originally envisaged this conference to be a no-deal rally, where you'll just kind of gear everyone up. To me, it doesn't feel like a no-deal rally. I think that if you speak to various ministers and MPs, I don't think people think we're necessarily leaving at the end of October on no deal. I think there is a sense that we could be heading to an extension, and it's how does the Tory party wear it? And I think recent polling, and lots of people talk about, Dominic Cummings' cunning plan and how people just don't quite understand the strategy. Now, it clearly hasn't gone to plan for number 10 on everything. That's an understatement. But I think there's still a view that this general narrative, what's happening now at Verity in the something they can use to play into this people versus parliament narrative. And perhaps, even if you do end up having to have an extension, whether Boris Johnson resigns or say the courts made him do it, is something the Tories can still use in a general election to say, everyone has stopped you, you have to give me a majority so I can finally get Brexit done, the slogan of this conference.
Right, well, given that we've got so many party activists in the room, perhaps we can do a quick show of hands, you can test here. Who, if the EU does reject the Conservatives, the government's latest offer, who would then be content to move to no deal? Who would not be content? Okay, James, what would you say that? It's about 80-20? I think it's more 90-10. David Gogg, what would you say that was?
I'd say not good.
Well, that's in the vote again until we get the right answer. Joe. Right. But Charles Grant, can I ask, from Brussels' point of view, if they reject the latest offer, it's actually a better situation than the one that the government is likely to be offered them? I mean, it's difficult to think that anybody... Well, I don't know, maybe you can tell me different, but... It's difficult to envisage a second referendum leading to Remain, but maybe in Brussels they think it will, and that would be preferable. So is that what they're holding out for? They're going to reject the best deal we're likely to get from this Conservative government?
I think it's wrong to think that Brussels is desperate to keep the British in the EU through another referendum. Mm-hmm. One or two countries really are. The Poles and Hungarians are distraught that we're leaving. So some one or two other countries as well are distraught.
The
Irish,
Sweden as well.
Yes, well, you know Sweden better than I do, but that's true. The Danes and maybe the Dutch. Mm-hmm. But most countries just want to get shot at the problem. We are a big distraction. If you talk to Macron's people, they say Macron's got a lot of good ideas for reforming the EU, for making it work better, but the EU can't focus on the Macron plans because it has to spend so much time and energy and effort dealing with the bloody British. So they do want to get shot at us.
So why don't they agree to the deal then?
Well, because they think they'll get a deal in the end. And they think a deal is quite likely in the end, or if not, they can live with no deal for a short period, because no deal is only a short time as far as they're concerned. If the British leave without a deal, the chaos in the UK, they come back and ask for a deal a bit later on their terms. And they will not even talk to us about a trade agreement if we leave without a deal, unless A, we give them the money, B, we guarantee citizens' rights, and C, we satisfy them on the Irish border. So they think they're in a very strong position and they hold nearly all the cards. So they are resigned to Britain leaving without a deal, at least in the short term. They don't want no deal. They hope there can be a compromise, but the latest government proposals, as far as we can tell what they are so far away from what's acceptable to them that they think on this basis no deal is possible before October the 31st.
So what they and the people in this room have got in common is they are actually quite prepared to go through with no deal.
They are. And the key thing for them is the Irish position. If the Irish were to say, well, let's accept the government's compromises and have some border controls a bit away from the border, not too visible, not too obvious a target for terrorism, if the Irish said, let's live with that, then France and Germany and others would follow the Irish because they want to get this business sorted. But so long as the Irish are saying they don't want to follow these compromise proposals of the British because of the threat to the peace process, then the rest of the EU will not back the Irish, will not let down the Irish. The second thing for the EU that matters, as well as the peace process, is the integrity of the single market. The EU believes, rightly or wrongly, that it can't police its customs union, its single market, the customs union, the single market. They can't therefore have no border controls.
Okay. David Gock, how's Tory conference going for you?
It's, well, so far it's been fine. But we'll maybe I'll tell you in about 45 minutes, Fraser. I recognise that in this room and at this conference, I'm very much in the minority in being against no deal. But I'm here to argue the case. I'm still a Conservative. I'm still an MP. I'm not a Conservative MP at the moment. But I still want to make the case for how I think we should move forward. And in my view, leaving without a deal would be a very bad idea for the British people.
Right. And you and Philip Hammond thinks the same as you, isn't that right?
Yes.
So can you say how enthusiastically the two of you prepared for no deal when that was your job in the Treasury?
Well, I think we did prepare for a no deal. We absolutely prepared for no deal, and yeah, billions were spent on it. And this idea that there was no preparation done until Boris Johnson became Prime Minister. Well, Boris Johnson said in March that he was very confident no deal. So not suddenly switch position and say nothing was done. Of course, Philip, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, was careful with the use of public money. And we shouldn't kid ourselves that every problem about no deal can be solved through preparations. But there was a lot of preparation done. There were a lot of problems that had been addressed. By the time we got to July, there's been further progress on that. But you know, preparations or not, no deal is a very bad outcome for the UK.
Right, so suffice to say your hearts weren't exactly in the job then?
No, I don't accept that at all. I mean, we always thought it was a bad outcome. But I mean, I've always argued that we have to prepare for no deal. The point that Charles makes that at some point or other the European Union might say, well, we're not extending anymore, or we're not prepared to accept the deal that you have. So no deal has always been a risk, and we've always had to prepare for it. But you know, the idea that you could solve all the issues, how do you prepare a Welsh sheep farmer for suddenly facing 40% tariffs on their sheep exports? It just, you know, you have got businesses that are currently viable that become unviable the moment we leave the Europeans.
Can you outline the scenario, realistic scenario, which is a strategy which is better to the government's current strategy?
Well, I think the strategy that the Prime Minister should seek to pursue is to find a majority in the House of Commons for a deal. I think there are Labour MPs who are looking to support a deal. Perhaps if we take a more emollient tone to some of them than we have done in recent days, that would help. And I think we should be trying to find a way in which we have a deal that maintains access to European markets. I just think we've got a real problem in terms of a red line that says get rid of the backstop. If we haven't got a technical solution to the Northern Ireland border where we say, you know, we will comply with the Good Friday Agreement, but we're also going to leave the customs union. How are you going to do those two things at the same time? There probably is a route through alternative arrangements through use of technology, but it's not ready yet. And we are not going to get a deal with the EU if we don't work. It's a technical problem, and it needs a technical answer, and we haven't found that answer.
So, James, David Scott raises an important point here. If we're not going to go for the backstop, and Boris Johnson has said he wants a backstopectomy, whatever he's going to propose, I guess we'll find out in the next few days, it won't be the backstop, it will be something else. Is there anything else that the British government can credibly say is credible?
I think the challenge is, I don't think it could be credible the next day. I think the problem is the sequencing of these talks, because everyone is trying to work out what needs to be done on the border when you don't yet know what the future relationship is between the UK and the EU. So you don't know which problem you are, what problem you are trying to solve. I mean, that is the issue. I also think the idea on Northern Ireland, to remove Northern Ireland from the customs territory of the UK is a fairly dramatic move, and I think you could argue that it goes against the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement as much as custom. I think one of the problems with the backstop and the way it is argued for is what the Good Friday Agreement said is that we're not going to do politics in Northern Ireland in a majoritarian way. We need both communities to consent to it. And it is quite clear to I think it is very hard to argue that there is unionist consent for the backstop in its current form. I think that is where the problem is. And so I think the question comes then, I think you could have some, I think the best kind of landing zone is some kind of regulatory border in the Irish Sea. And then I think you have to try and do customs involving technology, enhanced enforcement in the ports around the island of Ireland on both sides of the border. I think that is probably the best landing zone, but I don't see that as something that is likely to happen between now and October the 31st.
And Charles Grant, isn't a lot of this down to political goodwill? That if the EU or Dublin thinks, no, actually, we're just not in the mood for this. They're going to say it's impractical. Because whether it's practical or not depends to a large extent on whether you want to make it work.
I think it's a typical deal that men and women around a table late at night can sort it if they really wish. There are big, big legal and technical problems which the EU tends to focus on, which can't be wished away just through willpower. I mean, there's no example in the world of a customs union or a single market existing that isn't policed on its borders. And in order to ensure that the EU can police them, it has to have controls on the edge of those. So that means from the EU's point of view, really Northern Ireland has to be in a customs union with it. Otherwise, you have to have controls on the Northern Irish border, which Mrs. May said she wouldn't have, and now Boris Johnson says he would have. But you mentioned the future relationship phrase, and this matters for the issue of the Irish border, because if, as Boris Johnson says, he wants something like the Canada-style free trade agreement for the future relationship between the EU and the UK, with a lot of regulatory divergence, with Britain not following EU rules on social, environmental, consumer rights, and maybe state aid and tax too, then that means a huge regulatory gap between what happens in the European Union and what happens in the United Kingdom. That means the gap between the two halves of Ireland will be even greater, and is even, from the EU's point of view, even greater need for a backstop to ensure that the more Britain diverges in terms of regulation, the harder it is to solve the Irish border.
All right. So, Katie, let's say if a standoff proceeds as we expect, I mean, let's face it, if the EU were to agree to whatever Boris Johnson's proposing, first of all, do you think it would get through Parliament?
I'm quite sceptical. But that might just be the experience of covering Brexit and Theresa May's various attempts to pass a Brexit deal for about 3 years. and the number of times people say, oh, no, we're making progress. And you'll speak to politicians on both sides. There was always this faith in Downing Street and in Conservative circles that if they just got close enough, Labour MPs would follow and they would help the government out. I do think politics is still quite tribal. Even if we say people vote more in a Leave, Remain axis now, Labour MPs are very tribal. It is very difficult for you to help out, I think, a Conservative government. And I think that it is even harder for a Labour MP to help out Boris Johnson than Theresa May. I think there is more of a visceral dislike of Boris Johnson. If you look at the scenes in the House of Commons the past week, I mean, late into the night, but just so much bad will. And some Labour MPs will find it very difficult politically. I also think, I've spoken to a Labour whip, people in the Labour whip's office who have suggested that they might actually even, threaten deselection of any Labour MPs who want to vote for a Brexit deal. It's not firm policy yet, but that's the type of pressure you would suddenly get to. And I think because of the way this is gearing up, it's not even like Theresa May when it was, can she get a Brexit deal through? It didn't feel as though there was an election imminently after. So perhaps you could have done it and everyone would have had some time to try and move on after. We're heading to a situation where we all know a general election is coming. Boris Johnson has obviously realised that it's harder to have a general election than he first thought, but we still expect there to be a general election in the next couple of months, probably before Christmas. If Boris Johnson were to pass a Brexit deal, this government still has a working majority in the region of minus 40. it's not sustainable for it to keep going. So you're effectively allowing Boris Johnson to pass a Brexit deal, which might well give him a Brexit bounce in the polls before immediately going into a general election. I think that is politically a very difficult situation for Labour. You have people like Stephen Kinnock say there are about 40 Labour MPs who could vote for a deal. I think there are potential. I think an MP, for example, such as Lisa Nandy, you hear a lot on the radio, on the television, talking about a Brexit deal, how she wants to vote for a Brexit deal, hasn't done it yet, and I really can't. I'd be very surprised if she did eventually vote for a Brexit deal. I think that it's in the interest of lots of Labour MPs to talk about how they want to do it, but then potentially find a problem with whatever is put across. And if Boris Johnson is putting forward a looser relationship between the UK and the EU, that again is a harder sell to Labour MPs. So I think there are lots of problems there. We also saw under Theresa May the problems of having, you know, conservative Labour talks. It didn't make the progress they want. And that's before we even get to the European Research Group. Are they going to back a deal? You heard Marc Francois at this conference saying he would look at it, but I didn't. Some people got quite excited by that, but to me, I might say I will look at, you know, a takeaway menu. It doesn't mean I have any commitment to ordering anything from it.
Well, you normally do, actually.
But I normally go into Deliveroo.
Yeah, also Katie's a big Nando's fan as well, so okay. I rescind that comment. She would know anything as day class A is.
Yeah, my diet's probably not the best topic for this. But I just think all these factors up in the past week or so is speaking to some Conservative MPs who represent tight Labour-Tory marginals in areas that voted heavily to leave. They're very worried that Boris Johnson might actually come back for something, try and pass it, have it fail, and then have to go into a general election where Nigel Farage can say, look, they were, you know, putting lipstick on a pig and we stopped them once again and we are actually the only voice you can trust. So I think all those reasons to me mean that even if Boris Johnson does get something and the mood music at the moment isn't great on it, I think it's going to be a very big political call whether or not he actually puts it to a vote.
David Gough, you know the Labour Party quite well nowadays. So how many of them...
Not that well, Fraser.
Well, how many of your new friends would actually vote for a deal, do you think?
I think Katie makes a good point that to some extent we have put off some of those. I still think that is the best route, but it's still difficult. It's still really difficult.
McKinnock group has 40 so-called Labour MPs for a deal.
Yeah,
right?
I don't think you're going to get the 40. I think Katie's probably right. So it'll be a lower number than that. So it's not easy, but I think it's still the only way that you are going to get a deal through. Look, you know, the Labour Party are tribal. They don't like Boris Johnson. They like him less this week than they did last week. And that's a difficult situation for us. So I think I agree with Katie. I don't think, as someone who wants a deal to be reached as quickly as possible, I don't think we are going to end up with a deal one way or the other, either because we haven't set out a workable solution to the Irish backstop or because there aren't the numbers to get it through the House of Commons. I mean, I wish it was otherwise, but I fear that is the case.
Jim? I think one of the things that is striking to me about this conference is in the conversations you have, you know, in the bars and all that stuff, it is quite clear that that Downing Street is now working out how to fight an election after there has been an extension granted and what their strategy for that is going to be. And I think that they are now much more optimistic about their ability to still fight. It's obviously going to be tough, but to still fight and win an election even after they've been forced to go and get an extension. And I mean, the other thing that has firmed up in recent days is Boris Johnson isn't going to resign in any circumstances. I think Downing Street's view was that he would rather resign than preside over another extension. I think their strategy now is to press on, to try and find a way around the Benn Act. But I think if you read the Supreme Court judgment, there's a paragraph in that when they basically say, and don't think you can get around the Benn Act either in so many words, but I think their view is, if this ends up in the courts, they end up being ordered to get the extension. But the public blame for that, they think, among Brexit-supporting voters, won't land with him, but with the courts. And then they will basically say to the country, if you want to break this logjam, this gridlock, the only way to do it is to give me a majority and allow me to get this done. I think they think that's going to be quite a potent message.
Okay, let's take some questions. But before we do, can we do a show of hands for how many voted Remain at the last referendum? And how many voted Leave? So So, what, James, what do you say?
248, I'd say.
Perfectly representative sample of the population. Okay, let's take some questions. Put your hand up and then Cindy will come to you with the mic.
The biggest impediments to a deal so far has been the constant extensions. At the end of every period, we just get another extension. Does that then make the Benn Act part of the problem in that you're just going to keep on extending it, you don't have to reach a conclusion? I mean, it makes a deal less likely on that basis.
Charles Grant.
Yeah, I think that there is something what you say. Indeed, I hear Brussels officials saying the one thing they agree with on Boris Johnson on is that the extensions do reduce the pressure on both sides to compromise. Mm. But I think there's also the idea in this party that somehow we can persuade Poland or Hungary to veto an extension. This is, I'm afraid, for the birds. If you talk to other European governments, there's no problem. I mean, Poland and Hungary have enough battles to fight against Brussels already without adding a new front to their existing fights. Poland and Hungary or anybody else is not going to veto extensions, nor the French. There will be a veto eventually, though, because the EU's position is we can extend until June next year, but not beyond. Why June? Because that's when the EU has to agree to the 7-year budget cycle called the multi-annual financial framework, which really messes things up big time. So until then, there's actually a limit to the amount of damage the British can do in the EU. There aren't very many decisions that require unanimity until next June. So when I talk to EU governments, they tell me we don't mind further extensions if we have to have them, but beyond June, that's the ultimate deadline. No extensions beyond June.
And David, isn't that the criticism of what you've done? You basically made a deal less likely by just playing this extension card.
No, I'm absolutely... far from it. I'm absolutely convinced, having met with the Prime Minister on the 3rd of September, that the government was not working towards a deal at that point, and that we would have got to the end of October. I think the Prime Minister was sincere in his statement that, you know, we would leave, do or die, come what may, on the 31st of October. There were no proposals, workable proposals, to solve the Northern Ireland backstop issue. We're seeing that now when there is an absence of such proposals. He said earlier that the EU are not that frightened of no deal, so the idea that there's enormous leverage that we have about the threat of no deal would mean the EU were suddenly going to abandon all their negotiating positions. I think we were destined to leaving on the 31st of October without a deal, but for the Benn Act. So it wasn't stopping a deal Brexit, it was stopping a no deal Brexit. And by the way, leaving without a deal does not put Brexit behind us, because the next thing is that we then enter into very difficult, lengthy negotiations about our future relationship. It'll be harder to do so outside the EU at that point, and our leverage, such as it was, would be even weaker.
That's true.
Okay. Of the many Remainers in the room, how many think that David Gogg did the right thing? Thank you, Mrs. Gogg. No. Sorry, seriously, how many? Is that one, two... Okay.
Ten,
so you guys got to cheer more loudly when he speaks,
right?
So otherwise he can't move out. Yeah. So next time David says something, you'd go, yeah, at the end, right? You tell him, Dave. Right, Cindy, next question. Matt, sir.
Oh, hello. Gina Miller said, regarding if we criticise the judiciary for being biased, we're threatening democracy. But I'm thinking, institutions you said we should be proud of, we should be allowed to criticise them. It's freedom of speech. They have decisions, power to make decisions that affect us. So what's your opinion on that?
When it comes to particular, there's a distinction that Geoffrey Cox has drawn, which I think is a fair one, in that people may take a different view on a judgment. Quite a lot of lawyers thought that the Supreme Court might have gone the other way. I think as the case went on, it became clearer that the government wasn't prepared to argue for its justification for a 5-week suspension of Parliament. The Supreme Court, I think, probably moved its position. But if we start attacking the motives of the judiciary because we don't like their judgment, if we start calling into question their integrity, their impartiality, we end up with a system that we no longer have a sensible, civilized, effective way of resolving success of this country over centuries, is that we have been brilliant at resolving disputes, whether that's through our political system or whether it is through our judicial system. And if we start undermining the institution of an independent judiciary, I fear that we become a much more confrontational, divided, and less stable society. And that is not what conservatives should be arguing for.
James.
I think the fundamental problem right now is that our system is based on the assumption that the executive can command a majority in Parliament. And if it can't command the confidence of the House of Commons either replaces it, putting in a new government, or we have a general election. At the moment, we're in an absolutely bizarre situation where I think on what we'd all agree is the single biggest issue of the day, the House of Commons clearly does not have confidence in the government, yet it won't bring down the government and put in a new government or allow a general election. That is the entire problem. That is why the courts have been pulled into politics. And it would be much, much, I mean, the only way to resolve this is, I mean, the only constitutionally proper ways to resolve this would either be for the MPs who don't to agree on a new government that they could put in, or to go and have a general election and let the country decide. I mean, I think this the longer this the longer this stalemate continues, the more recourse to the courts we're going to have, and the more bitter and tense our politics is going to become. I don't think the general election campaign at the moment is going to be particularly edifying, but I think it is the only way to resolve this impasse.
Let's take lots of hands. Let's try and take questions in groups. Sir, and then that Sir Christopher Mayer, a former ambassador to the US, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Okay, but after you, sir, and then pass to Sir Christopher.
Thank you. Probably one for David. The law is that Boris Johnson should sign the letter and request the extension. If he doesn't, then somebody has to go to court and get an order that tells him to do so. He may not take any notice of that order. And when people ignore court orders, traditionally the courts fine them, lock them up, but that doesn't get the letter written. Another remedy that the court has is to step in itself and sign the letter. So in those circumstances, should the Supreme Court exercise that power and actually make the...
And let's take another... let's take another two.
One's completely different.
Oh, is it? You know, that's such a good point, actually, and...
This isn't
supposed to be David got questions.
But there is already a case in the Scottish court on based on precisely the premise of your question. It's asking the court to step in and to take on the technical, David will correct me when I go wrong, to take on the legal personality of the Prime Minister and send the letter seeking the extension. Again, you know, I suspect that they'll never admit it, but I suspect that in private, Downing Street would not be too distraught if we ended up with a judge sending a letter to Brussels asking for an extension.
You can see the plot.
I've got a question, I think, probably for Charles. I don't know, Fraser, you're in charge here. I wanted to look at something completely different and ask the question, have Brussels and the government of the Republic of Ireland sorted out what would happen to the border in the event of a no deal? Because we are told that for the sake of the integrity of the single market, it would be necessary to put in checks and controls of a hard physical. Sorted that problem out, why can't we borrow it for north of the border?
Well, I can answer part of your question, Christopher, I think. Behind the scenes in private, there have been some quite heated exchanges between the Commission and the Irish government. Because the Commission, spurred on by the French, has argued that the Irish government has not made sufficient preparations for the border in the event of no-deal Brexit. And the Commission has said to the Irish, look, if you don't put controls on that border very soon after no-deal Brexit, we will put controls on the border between Ireland and the rest of the EU, which the Irish don't like at all. That has been the threat to the Irish made in private by the Commission. So the Irish are actually now saying, well, we will put some controls on the border. There's an argument going on, and I'm not privy to the details, as to how many controls and what form they would be. There would be controls on the border, to which you may say, or many people say, well, then if the Irish know that no deal means the controls on the border, why don't they accept getting rid of the backstop and having controls anyway? The answer is simple. It's political. If a no deal forces the Irish to put some controls on the border, firstly, they can blame the British. It's Britain's fault. We didn't want to do this. It's the bloody British who forced us into this. Secondly, firstly, they blame the British. Secondly, the control, perhaps wrongly, in the event of no deal, it won't last very long because the British will be so disadvantaged they'll come and ask for a deal after a few weeks or a few months. So that's why, politically, if Varadkar agrees to get rid of the backstop, he's finished. He'll be attacked by everybody else in Ireland for caving into British imperialism. But if he stands firm and the Irish have to put up controls for a few weeks in the way we've suggested, then politically he's in a much stronger position.
Right. Next question.
Diana Glover. I just wanted to ask David Gawke that I think possibly what sticks in the claw of a lot of Conservative Party members is that Boris actually went through quite a stringent leadership campaign and won over half of the support of the MPs and two-thirds of the party members. And what the Rebel 21, now Rebel 20, have actually done is taking the executive powers away from a leader that was actually elected by its own party, and you haven't recognised the democracy within the Conservative Party.
I think fundamentally there is a responsibility for members of Parliament to look at the issues in front of us, important constitutional issues, issues that are going to affect the livelihoods of millions of our fellow citizens, and to make an assessment on what they believe is the right course of action for the national interest. Now, there will be people of good faith who will reach very different conclusions on this, and I hear the argument that, you know, we've just got to get Brexit done, and the sooner we leave, the better. But the view that I took and others took was that had we not acted on the 3rd and 4th of September, we would have left the European Union without a deal on the 31st of October, that such an outcome would have been deeply damaging for the country. By the way, I think it would have been deeply damaging to the economic credibility of the Conservative Party, which has always been the party of economic competence. And the conclusions that some of us took was that the national interest required us to vote for the Bent Act. Now, the consequence for me, we were warned beforehand that the whip was going to be taken away, but, you know, notwithstanding the votes in the leadership election, MPs have a responsibility to act in what they see as the national interest. And that's what I and 20 colleagues did. And although, you know, I have always enjoyed being a Conservative MP, I would like to be a Conservative MP again. In all honesty, I don't regret the decision that I took, and I don't think any of the others do either.
Okay. And given that the government's now got a majority of minus 41, therefore, you struggle to see a Queen's speech being passed in such circumstances. You struggle to see anything productive coming out of Parliament where the government has lost its majority. So isn't the thing that we do in the British system to then just throw it over to the public in a general election?
Well, I think that is coming. In my view,
you haven't supported this.
No, let me make this point. I think that it is, if we don't secure the extension first, that the purposes of the Bent Act could have been frustrated one way or the other. So my belief, I accept there is a general election coming. It's not far off, and in the end, this is going to return to the British people, and that is not within a few months.
Who in this room is looking forward to that election? Show of hands. And who is not particularly looking forward to it? What do you say, James?
Our events team.
Okay, let's take another couple of questions. Cindy. Yep. Matt.
Just to follow up on the previous question and answer, isn't it time that we change the voting system? That we have 486 Member of Parliament who are Remainers versus 160 Member of Parliament who are Leavers, and yet we had an election, a referendum where every individual had a vote. So maybe shouldn't we change the system from first past the post?
To what? To proportional representation or something?
Yeah.
That's a good, you know, the Lib Dems are very keen on that.
Be represented.
I know, that's... James, let's take more questions. Let's take another couple.
Sorry. I just wanted to get the panel's opinion on Charles Grant's comment that the EU are okay with the idea of no deal because they think the impact will be so big on the UK that it'll be back at the table and their cards will be even stronger. Is the EU correct?
Okay, and let's take a third question and we'll try them in a group. So, do we need a new voting system? Will Britain come begging back the EU for a deal? And
to what extent do you think the battle lines of the future general election has been completely changed from party politics to Leave and Remain?
A good, very good question, sir. Okay, let's quick thoughts on any of those, James.
So on changes, I mean, the problem with the electoral system is the 2017 election. Theresa May went to the country to try and get a majority for her Brexit party and came back without a majority because the 2017 election was meant to be about Brexit, but because of various missteps by the Conservatives and Jeremy Corbyn seizing the moment, it turned out to be about a whole bunch of other issues, and that meant that you had a parliament that was, again, out of sync with the referendum result. I think on the question of whether the UK comes back to the table, let us imagine the intriguing element of this, which is, let us imagine that, let's go quite a long way down lots of hypotheticals here. If Boris Johnson were to win a majority for a five-year term, and then there was to be no deal, I think it is less likely that the UK comes crawling back to the table because he's got 5 years before he has to go to the country again. And while as I think that no deal would undoubtedly be economically disruptive in the short to medium term, over a five-year period, you're beginning to be able to do things that by the time that general election came around in 5 years' time, you might well be able to turn around to voters and say, look, it was tough, it was choppy, we had a very hard 2 or 3 years, but we can now see the valley below, so stick with us. I think on the question about which axis does British politics revolve on now, has it stopped working on a left-right axis and works on a Remain-Leave axis, I think is fascinating. Because the Tories and the Lib Dems have bet the house that it now operates on a Leave-Remain axis. I think one of the most intriguing developments in British politics recently is Chuck Ramuna, who is, you know, could basically have had a pick of almost any Lib Dem to fight a seat on the South East, has chosen to fight a seat where the Lib Dems came third with 11% of the vote at the last election. Why has he done that? Because it's cities of London and Westminster, and it voted 70% plus to Remain. And he's therefore convinced that because politics is now about Leave Remain rather than left-right, he can come through the middle or come from third place and win that seat. The Tories are betting that it's now all about Brexit, so they can pick up a bunch of traditionally Labour voting seats that voted to leave. Jeremy Corbyn's taking a completely different view. He's trying to use his second referendum policy to essentially put a kind of cordon sanitaire around Brexit as a question and say, why don't you vote on what you think about austerity? I think, you know, this election result is going to tell us very clearly whether British politics is a leave-remain contest now or whether ultimately voters still care more about domestic issues than they do about Brexit.
Can I ask one of the many Remainers in the audience whether, just anybody make an answer to this question, put your hand up, just whether you're starting to feel uncomfortable in the Conservative Party as it becomes a Brexit party? And you would like to say a little bit about it? Sir, go on.
Yes, no.
Why not?
I voted Remain, but I'm a Democrat. And I believe that we should leave, but it was never part of the deal that that in leaving we should wreck the Irish peace process. That was never suggested for one moment. And in defence of Mr. Gawke, and in my defence, the members of the ERG group voted time and time again against Mrs. May's deal. And but for them, and the opportunism of the Labour Party, we would now be out on sensible terms. Mm. And what I would like to suggest is that the best course for the Prime Minister is to make a few improvements to Mrs. May's deal, put in some safeguards for employment rights and environmental rights, and bring it back. And if it's thrown, if it's defeated again, go to the country on that deal.
Okay, thanks, sir.
Brexit. If we do leave without a deal, and then we want a trade agreement. We lost Article 50, which gives the leaving country a lot of protections and rights. You have to negotiate that deal under Article 218, which requires unanimity on the EU side. So every single EU country will say, No deal if you're Spain, unless we get more fishing rights. No deal if you're Germany, unless we get more level playing for provisions on social and environmental issues. So it gives the EU massive more clout than it has today with the current situation, Article 50, where it's a majority vote. So you're in a very weak position, and also you cannot negotiate future free trade agreements in practice until you've sorted out the relationship with the EU. No, almost no country in the rest of the world wants an FTA with Britain until it knows what Britain's relationship is with the EU. And if you leave without a deal and delay the negotiation of the future trading arrangements, any future FTA with Australia, New Zealand, Korea, Singapore, whoever, will be delayed too.
Final question to David Gogg. Do you see a time, David, where, I don't know, in a few years' time, you might be at a Tory conference in slightly happier circumstances where you're being cheered by the average conference crowd? So how do you see this? Do you see a happy ending to this?
Well, I hope so, but I am anxious about a number of things. If we do leave, that's so problematic. But I do tend to agree with James at this point. I think politically we'll probably double down on that, and we'll, you know, the Conservative Party will say, oh, it's all the fault of the Europeans and probably Philip Hammond and so on. And that, I think, is a difficult situation, because I think we will move into a more antagonistic relationship with the European Union. And what I do worry about in terms of this left-right leave-remain axis is one of the fears that we ought to have as a party is there a risk that in London and the South East it becomes much more leave and remain, so cities of Westminster and London becomes vulnerable to the Liberal Democrats. But in those northern seats, in Bolsover, for example, the Labour leavers are more Labour than they are Leave. And we run a risk with that strategy that we lose seats in London and the southeast of England to the Liberal Democrats and don't pick up seats in the north and the Midlands from the Labour Party. And if we do that, the Conservative Party is in deep trouble.
Oh, we'll find out soon enough. David, Katie, James and Charles, thanks. Thanks to our producer, Cindy Yu, and thanks to our guests here in Manchester.